day.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 10th, 2015, and this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. We are going to be continuing our public hearing today on the Bureau of Labor and Industries at Senate Bill 5517. Ms. Deister, did you have anything for us before I gavel in for a continuation of the presentation?
All I would tell you is that the slide deck is under meeting materials for yesterday, and we left off on slide number 27.
So. Slide 27. All right. Well, let me go ahead and reconvene the public hearing on 5517. Commissioner Vakian, I know you were going to lead off today, and then turn us over probably to the Civil Rights Division.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Labor of Industries. Thank you, Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you once again for our chance to present our agency budget to you. Yesterday, you heard from our Apprenticeship and Training Division and our Wage and Hour Division. Today, Amy Clare will start first, the Administrator of our Civil Rights Division, and then Jennifer Germanson from our Technical Assistance for Employers Program.
Excellent. Well, we thank you for being with us, and we look forward to hearing more. Welcome, Ms. Clare.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm pleased to appear before you today to give an overview of what the division does. Let me click over. So the Civil Rights Division works to ensure that Oregonians are treated fairly in employment, housing, public accommodations. We enforce laws that grant job seekers and employees equal access to jobs, promotions, and a work environment free from discrimination and harassment. We provide retaliation protection when reporting workplace safety violation, using family leave or workers' compensation system, and we protect individuals seeking housing or the use of public facilities, such as retail establishments or transportation, and we work to ensure equal access to career schools. So these are just some quick facts. I'm going to start with the 38,000 inquiries per year, because that's at the intake level. So our intake unit and actually our support staff now are helping with this. They field approximately 38,000 to 40,000 phone calls a year regarding possible discrimination. That translates down to about 1,700 formal complaints filed each year. The vast majority, 90%, are
sorry,
in...
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Yes.
It occurs to me that either people don't understand what the scope of your ability to respond is. You had 38,000 calls, and a fraction of them turned into real issues. Are you guys not doing a good job getting out the word about what you can and can't do? Or explain to me 38,000 turns into 1,700.
Senator Johnson, thank you for your question. We believe this is an important service we actually provide. Folks sometimes do call us about issues relating to issues that, like, perhaps, you know, workers' comp that's not workers' comp retaliation or discrimination, but we can explain where they should go or the employment department. But a lot of the calls are from people that are upset about something happening in the workplace or in their housing, but it happens not to be something that is based on a protected class. So they have a conflict with an a coworker or a supervisor that perhaps doesn't rise to the level of discrimination that's unlawful. So we explain to them what the realities are about the law. And I'm going to be speaking later about our triaging system. That's why you might see our inquiries have stayed steady or going up each year, but our number of complaints has actually gone down because we're doing a much more aggressive job of screening calls and complaints at the intake level to really focus our resources on the cases that may have merit.
Ms. Clerk, the microphones now are so super sensitive that maybe if you just moved away.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Okay. Senator, did that get your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me follow up on that a little bit, if I could, Ms. Clare. I mean, the Senator makes a wonderful point about 38,000 translating into 1,700, and I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of these phone calls, whether people are getting off the phone and saying, gee, I hadn't thought about it that way, or are they getting off the phone and saying, darn, state government just doesn't care, doesn't listen. I mean,
which we tried for the former, Representative Gomberg. I actually can hear the staff outside of my office fielding a number of these calls, and a lot of them have to do with you know, my boss is mean to me, my coworkers are, you know, sometimes you hear about workplace bullying. At this point, if it's not based on a protected class, like your race, your gender, your religion, your sexual orientation, then it's not unlawful to discrimination itself is not unlawful, it's just a differentiation. So, you know, you have people have personality conflicts, but that's not protected under the civil rights statutes.
So again, I'm not arguing that you're giving inaccurate information, but it's my impression that a lot of people are going away from your phone lines unhappy with the response.
Well, a lot of them will call us, and then as we're in the screening process, we find out if they're articulating something that we may have jurisdiction over, we'll send them a, what's called a complaint questionnaire. And a lot of those folks make the initial inquiry, they get the questionnaire, and then they may not send it back to us.
If I could reinforce that, that has been my experience, that people call up just in my regular constituent work, and if you ask them to reduce the issue to writing, they don't. And I'm just trying to figure out how much time you expend on fielding those 38,000 calls, whether or not you could just say, if you've got an issue, respond in writing. It's so easy to pick up the phone and just complain about something. Do you track the time that you spend on those 38,000 calls?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, we don't keep a precise count, but I will tell you that previously when I've testified before you, it was three intake officers fielding all these calls. Now all the support staff have been trained at least to do the rudimentary screening, so it's pretty quick. We try to get people, get their answers to them quickly so they don't have to go to a voicemail system. So a phone will ring up. If somebody's not able to answer, it'll ring on to someone else's phone. So we try to get those conversations over within 5 minutes. If it looks like it's going to go longer, then they have to get referred to an intake officer. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Well, thanks for those quick answers, those fast answers. Let's get back to the fast facts.
Okay. So the vast majority of the complaints we receive are in the area of employment. The remaining 10% is in housing, career schools, and places of public accommodation. The top filings are disability at 31%, sex discrimination. Now, sex discrimination includes, obviously, different treatment based on sex, sex harassment, and sex pregnancy, and wage discrimination based on gender. Injured worker claims are about 17% of the caseload, and race color is about 16%. And I'd like to point out that frequently individuals, actually in the vast majority of cases, they will file on more than one protected class. So somebody that's filing on disability may also be filing on family leave or gender discrimination as well. So this is just a graph showing you the inquiries that we receive. They've steadily increased. It went down slightly in 2014, but our tracking may not be perfect. I really feel that it's been around 38 to 40,000 each year. And then as you'll see, the complaints are fairly steady, but they've gone down slightly, and that's due to more intense screening at the intake level. And then this is where I'm going to talk a little bit about our triaging system.
How many hours are in a year?
The Civil Rights Division has a triaging system that we try to optimize our investigative resources to focus on the most meritorious complaints by expediting the closure of cases unlikely to result in a finding of unlawful discrimination. A cases are distinguished by a high likelihood of a cause finding related to an egregious violation, pose simple questions of public concerns. These are more rare. You hardly ever get, you know, something, a bullseye right at the intake level, but once in a while we see those, and we mark them as such at the intake level. As the investigation progresses, they could get marked down. The majority of our cases are what we call B cases. They need more information to determine whether substantial evidence exists, so we'll likely have to interview witnesses and get a position statement from a respondent. And then C cases are those at intake that the complainant has offered no reason to believe further investigation is likely to yield substantial evidence of an unlawful practice. Those are those types of cases where I was talking about might be a personality conflict with a coworker. It may be that they are just surmising that the treatment they received is based on a protected class, but they have no evidence or no documentary evidence or witnesses to the alleged discrimination.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Go back to the last slide, if you wouldn't mind. In every one of those, your ABCs, it's probably only A's and B's, let's assume that there is a high likelihood of a cause finding.
Mm-hmm.
Is the employer then given the opportunity to respond, or the housing owner, the apartment owner. Do you just hear from one side of each one of these stories, or where's the due process?
Thank you, Senator Johnson. So at the intake level, we're hearing just from the complainant, and we're screening it based on what we call A, B, or C. When it gets to the investigative level, so at the intake level, they're saying we think it's going to be A, B, or C. When it's referred to investigation, and mainly the B case, A and B cases are referred for full investigation. I can explain more about C cases that are truly what we call they have no merit. They're not even articulating a protected class, but they insist on filing. We do an intake interview, and we send out notifications to the respondent, but we don't even ask for a position statement because we know that we will not find substantial evidence. But for the A and B cases, once the case is open, the allegations are sent to the respondent or the landlord, if it's an employer or a landlord, and then we give them an opportunity to respond within a finite amount of time. In employment, it's 2 business weeks, and we often will give them an extension of 10 days. And that way, we have, you know, the response, what we call the legitimate non-discriminatory reason. That's usually what they articulate of why they took the action they did. So when the investigator's conducting their interview, they're confirming the allegations from the complainant, but then they also have the respondent's position, and they say, well, you said you were fired for this, but your respondent, you know, your employer said you failed a drug test, and they have all this evidence here. And if the complainant cannot overcome what the respondent has defended themselves with, we close the case right away.
Follow-up? Is it safe to say that the respondent knows as soon as the investigatory phase commences?
I would say so, because once the case is open, all parties are notified at the same time. So the formal charge that goes out is mailed out to the complainant. If the complainant has an attorney, it goes out to the complainant's attorney. Then it goes out to the respondent, and if the respondent has counsel, it goes out to the respondent's counsel and registered agents.
One more follow-up.
Please.
Are these form letters or are these one-off letters designed for the prevailing fact scenario?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, the complaint that is unique to that individual's circumstances goes out, what we call the formal charge. So it has the allegations that are specific to the complaint. Then there is like a form letter that explains to them who their investigator is, when the interview is scheduled, if it's pre-scheduled, or that they need to contact the interview for a schedule. We ask for a position statement responding to the allegations within 14 days. Does that answer your question?
Yes, in the main. What I'm trying to get at, is there a time certain when all parties know that a case has been opened, and is there a time certain when all parties know that the case has concluded?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, I can't speak to when their knowledge happens, but the notification letters go out to the parties all at the same time, and then the investigation ensues. There will be, depending on how the case is triaged, there'll be interviews, there'll be requests for documents, and then when the case is going to be closed for lack of substantial evidence, or if there's going to be notice of substantial evidence where we find unlawful discrimination, the parties are all notified by the investigator at the same time.
Okay, I'm not going to beat this to death, but it occurs to me that when it's distinguished by a high likelihood of a cause finding, I'm hunting for the due process. That seems to be conclusionary, and I guess I'm just feeling cranky about due process today.
All right. Well,
you don't have to answer.
And we'll move along then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So this slide is represents a composite performance measure for the division, and it's easier for me to talk about it and to break it out into its parts. But basically, it tracks how well we do in terms of timeliness, from the intake level that we've been talking about through the completion of an investigation. So at the end, there's 4 parts of this composite performance measure, and the first one is responding to initial inquiries. We have a goal of responding to all initial inquiries 85% of the time within 2 business days. We always exceed that because we're trying to answer calls contemporaneously, and that has been a performance goal that we've been able to achieve consistently. A newer performance goal that we have is to complete. So once we get back, that's an inquiry. Once we get complaint questionnaires back to us. We have a goal of completing those, drafting a charge from that complaint, from that questionnaire, within 15 days or fewer. And that's pretty challenging because we often have to contact the complainant again and get do a second interview with them. And that has been a challenge for us to meet that. But in the first few quarters of this fiscal year, we've been achieving that. So I think that's going to be one of our big challenges. But so far, we're doing fairly well. Then the third composite of the measure is at the investigative level, is conducting the initial interview. This is the interview at the investigative interview where you're doing a rebuttal interview because you have the position statement from the respondent. That's within the first 45 days of opening the case. We try to achieve that 65% of the time. And then the final part of that performance measure is completion of case investigation within 180 days. By statute, for the vast majority of our cases, we have up to a year to complete our investigations, but we believe that both parties, both the complainants and the respondents, are best served by a quicker outcome. So we try to complete 65% or more of our investigations in 180 days.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator Johnson.
I'm curious about the confidentiality of this work product and about records retention and access to those records. I would presume that they are considered a public record.
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, they are public records. Open case files are not subject to disclosure until the case file is closed. However, the complaint that is filed with us is a public record that can be disclosed from the beginning, so that the position statement of the respondent, if there's medical records, those have to be exempted out. But nothing that's under investigation can be disclosed to third parties until the case is closed.
Follow?
Please.
So the case is closed. Who typically would access those records? Are they accessed? Do you keep track of who's in and out of your closed files?
Yeah. Senator Johnson, members of the committee, we have an active case. We have a full-time equivalent position just to complete case file copies and public records requests. They come in two main arenas. One is parties that are going to move on to litigation, the attorneys for both sides will request copies of the case file, and they'll get those. And then if it's a relatively high profile or of interest to the media, we get media inquiries regarding case files. We frequently get media inquiries regarding, you know, I want all open case files against one particular entity filed within this finite period, and they can get copies of the complaints. And then if they want to get a copy or look at a case file, they'll put that request in, and they have to wait till the case is closed.
Those are the two principal ones.
Right.
Parties moving to litigation and media inquiries.
Correct.
Do others come and peruse your files?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, on occasion.
And characterize those.
Sometimes folks that are from educational ones, or they're doing research projects, or folks that are just active in whatever, depending on the subject matter of the investigation, sometimes people in academia are interested, or sometimes just members of the public. But to be realistic, the majority of the folks that are filing public records requests with us are the media and parties to the complaint.
Thank you.
And then I just wanted to share, and I've been sort of talking about this, but how we've been able to, I think, be able to do more with fewer people is that we received legislative approval and authority in 2003 to reclassify two existing field intake officer positions, which were range 19, to field rep representatives range 21. That means that these are intake officers, but now they can do investigations as well. And so they're able to help out, take on some of the caseload that's been assigned to the investigators or the senior investigators. And then we were able to get a third intake officer position during the 2003-2015 biennium. And that's really helped us to be more efficient at the intake level and also do those screening. And we've greatly improved our intake backlog, and we'll continue to try to achieve our performance goals in that area.
Senator Johnson.
Is there a standard training protocol that establishes sort of minimum qualifications for somebody handling these cases? What I'm getting at is that with the high turnover in DHS, for example, they have caseworkers coming into extraordinarily complex cases with little or no training. And those are resulting in a kind of mixed bag of results. I presume not all of your clerical support staff are lawyers. What's the minimum standard to know how to do this?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, I can get back to you with the specific minimum qualifications for the positions of intake officer, but I will tell you that some of them have been attorneys, but this is a range 19. It's not a super high paying job, but I feel like when I've been with the agency now 12 years, when I first started, there was high turnover in the intake unit. There wasn't a lot of consistency, but we've been very fortunate over the successive years that we've stabilized that unit. I think we have a good training program. We have a veteran senior investigator now who's a lead worker who worked his way up from intake, so he has developed a big training program for it. So it's very detailed training program for new intake officers, and we've found that there's more retention there and that they're able, many times they promote on to senior investigator levels. Now, in terms of the clerical staff, I can assure you that none of the clerical staff are attorneys, but they do answer, you know, basic civil rights intake type questions, and they do preliminary screening. If it's getting more complicated, then they have to take a number and refer it on to the intake officers.
Thank you. Other questions? All right, let's continue.
That's the end of my portion. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Ms. Clare, when we get one of those high-profile media attention cases, how does that affect your overall costs? How would a high-profile, intense case like that cost the state money?
Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, I'm not quite, I mean, for just the cost of doing the investigation?
Well, and any of the follow-up, the records requests, any appeals?
So the records requests, we are able to recoup our costs. We can actually charge for the time, and it's in our Oregon administrative rules. So we try to recoup our costs. It actually funds one office specialist position, although all of our office specialists are doing the case copying. I may have to get back to you about the cost of litigation, and I don't know that the high-profile cases are more costly in terms of our, I mean, sometimes they're more labor-intensive, but they're over quickly because we prioritize our cases so that we try to, not necessarily high-profile, but those that we believe have strong merit, we try to adjudicate those as quickly as possible. So I'd be happy to consult with our fiscal unit and try to get back to you on the actual costs.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right, well,
okay,
we appreciate you being with us this afternoon.
So Jennifer Jermanson is up next. She's our technical assistant for Employers Manager.
Welcome, Ms. Jermanson.
Thank you.
I'll invite you to introduce yourself for the record, even though we've mentioned your name three times.
Thank you. Okay, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Jermanson. I'm the manager of the Technical Assistance for Employers program with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the program, the services that BOLI provides for Oregon employers, hopefully before they are contacted by one of the enforcement divisions. So Technical Assistance for Employers exists solely to educate and advise Oregon employers on wage and hour, civil rights laws, and other employment laws that affect Oregon employers. We do this through a variety of ways. One of the most important services we provide is a telephone and an email service where Oregon employers can contact us by telephone or by email and ask their questions. We get around 20,000 inquiries per year that we respond to, and I will talk a little bit later about some of the improvements we've made to that service. This is where employers can contact the Technical Assistance for Employers program and get generally an immediate response to their questions. When I say there are 20,000 inquiries inquiries per year that we respond to. And on the next slide, you'll see that we respond to around 17,000. We get a number of phone calls from employers that have nothing to do with the areas that BOLI enforces. We get questions about workers' compensation. We get a lot of questions about unemployment insurance. Right now, we're getting a lot of questions about immigration laws. So although we don't answer those questions, we have to take those calls from those employers and provide resources, give them referrals to where they need to go to get answers to those questions. So we don't turn anyone away. So we are a bit of a referral service as well.
So let me ask about that for just a moment, if I could. A wonderful service. How do you let people know it's available?
Wonderful question, Chair Gomberg. We recently worked with the Oregon Employment Department, and they do a quarterly tax mailing to let employers know about their tax rates for unemployment insurance. We have a mailing that goes out with that. I will tell you that I believe the next round of mailings, we're going to change a little bit of our flyer because we're getting a lot of questions about employers' tax rates. We really want those employers to know that we provide other services, but not about unemployment insurance tax rates. We also have an email list that has around 7,000 names on that, and employers are able to go to our website and put their name in, and they get those emails where we send out information about upcoming seminars. We do try to do weekly advice columns on a variety of topics that we're getting a lot of calls about. We also work with chambers. The Small Business Development Center gets emails about our upcoming seminars and those advice columns, and any other business organization that we can find a contact to let them know this is what we're here for. We're here to do seminars. We're here to answer your questions.
It's interesting. One part of your answer I found particularly interesting, knowing that the Employment Division has their own telephone resource center, but they're doing their mailings and telling their constituents to call you. Did I get that right?
That's correct. It's just another service that that they can provide to Oregon employers. They hit every employer in Oregon, where BOLI is not able to do that at this point. We don't have access to all of those lists. But they have added that because I'm sure they get a lot of the same phone calls that BOLI gets that they're not able to answer. We get a large number of phone calls from employment regarding employment department, unemployment insurance in particular, and I think they're using this also as a way maybe to cut down on the number of phone calls they get that they have to refer to BOLI.
Well, and that leads me to the question that that my co-chair and I both asked the director yesterday, and I'd invite you to comment further, if you would, on the various programs we see in the state, your Telephone Resource Center, the Employment Division, the Small Business Assistance Center within Secretary of State. Tell us about the potential for overlap or redundancy, or whether we're just reaching broader audiences, having a multiple opportunities for people to call.
Okay. Chair Gomberg, I think that is an excellent question. I think that each one of these agencies provides very specific services. The programs are not the same. And I think by the different agencies working together, we are able to get information out to those employers. I will tell you that in technical assistance, it takes at least 2 years to get someone fully competent answering all the variety of questions that come into us. I think you'd almost have to be superhuman if you had one agency or a group of individuals who could answer all the questions about workers' compensation and business licenses and unemployment insurance and taxes, wage and hour, civil rights, employment laws. There may be some duplication of efforts, but I know that we work very closely with the small business or the Secretary of State office, the small business group. We work with them closely to ensure they know what we do. We refer our callers to them. We refer callers to workers' compensation, to business licensing, to the employment department.
All right. Understood. If you'd like to go on, thank you.
Thank you. In addition to the phone and email service, we conduct public seminars as well as customized on-site seminars throughout the state. In the last program year, we conducted 167 different training sessions. 100 of those were customized on-site training sessions. These were for organizations. Some small business development centers have had us come in. We do a lot of work with cities and counties who contract with us to come in and provide customized training to all of their employees. So 100 of our seminars in the last year were customized for those employers. And then we also conduct public seminars throughout the state on a variety of topics, wage and hour laws that affect every single Oregon employer. One of our more popular new seminars has been a six-month new supervisor seminar series that we've conducted in Portland. This year we sent that out to Eugene as well, and have had a number of requests from different parts of the state to bring that to their area. People are promoted into supervisory positions because they're good at their job, and frequently they don't understand the laws and what they need to do as supervisors to protect their employer. And I certainly could tell you that the Wage and Hour Division and the Civil Rights Division can tell you a number of cases where employers have got into some hot water. Their supervisors are not well trained to understand the laws. So what we are trying to do is trying to prevent those types of cases coming on board. The program also writes and publishes 8 employer handbooks that are sold for fees from $25 to $40 per handbook. We try to update those every year, every other year. We're currently working on, we have a new wage and hour handbook coming out for 2015, but we're also working on a supervisory practices handbook that we think will be very helpful to employers. We update composite posters every year. Every year in January and February, we start getting phone calls from businesses who are upset because they were billed for a poster they didn't order, or they are being maybe bullied a little bit into purchasing composite posters from private companies. Although we provide all of the commonly required federal and state posters for free download on our website, we also put together composite posters and sell those as a service for employers. We maintain a website with fact sheets. We have fact sheets on anything from rest and meal period rules to the Oregon Family Leave Act rules. We provide forms, templates for employers, and fact sheets as well on our website. We try to keep those updated as well as we can, and try to add to that when possible. We also are writing weekly or sometimes monthly employer advice columns on current topics. For example, at the first of the year, we wrote a column on minimum wage questions, the questions that are coming into the technical assistance program frequently, providing that information. We're also sending that out to our email list. We're providing it to chambers and to other business organizations who might want to post that on their website or send it out to their members. And then each year, we hold an annual employment law conference. This is generally the November, December every year, with 24 to 28 different sessions. It's a 2-day seminar. We attract employers from all over Oregon as well as other states who have businesses with Oregon employees. And this year was our 30th, next year's our 31st, and we generally get around 300 to 350 attendees at that annual conference.
So I wanted to go back to the poster question.
Okay.
Being a small business owner, I think my retail doors were open for about 20 minutes before we got our first phone call from one of those companies offering to sell us posters that you folks provide at no cost. Any reaction to the environment out there? You used the word bullying, which I did not find inappropriate. And so we've got a situation where people are offering to sell things that you provide for free. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Again, an excellent question, Chair Gomberg. Members of the committee, maybe Bowley needs to do a better job of marketing and advertising that information. I do know that every year when the minimum wage announcement is made, Bowley always sends out releases with information about the posters, when they'll be available and where to access them. That may be as we continue to work with the Secretary of State's office as well as the Employment Department on providing information about Bowley technical assistance to employers in their mailings to all Oregon employers. Maybe we need to do a better job of getting that information out to those Oregon employers. Yes, you need a poster. No, you don't need to purchase a poster. You can download it or you can purchase it from Bowley Technical Assistance for $12.50. A better job of getting the information out. And we do have a number of employers who will call every year with a question about a specific rule, and technical assistance staff will talk to the employer about, you know, take a look at your poster, and your employees will know what that means. What poster? What are you talking about? So maybe better information to all employers that you need this, and not only the minimum wage poster, there's a number of other posters that you're going to need to remain in compliance.
Thank you.
Just some of, again, fast facts, as you saw for the Civil Rights Division. In the last program year, we trained roughly close to 5,000 employers. And this is not just employers that come to our public seminars, it's as well as the on-site seminars, but we do a number of trainings at no fee upon request. So I went out to the Malala Chamber several months ago. Malala had 37 people come to this training. They had no idea that we existed and that we could provide all these resources to them. So a significant number of employers, but it's a very small number of employers who were able to access this service or maybe know about the service. We already talked a little bit about the responses to the inquiries, the number of seminars that we do. The seminars are rated very, very highly. 92% of the seminars are rated either above average or excellent. We rarely get anything other than, every now and then we get an average rating, and then the trainer always is very upset about that. 99.6% of that almost 20,000 phone calls were returned within one business day or less. And again, I'm going to talk about it now. Last year at the end of the year, in the past, when employers would call Technical Assistance for Employers, they would have to leave a message. They did not get an immediate pickup. We were able to do some configuration of our phone service at the end of 2013, where the phone will ring on each one of the technical assistance staff desk. And we did very well in picking that phone up immediately. It's been a huge service. Employers are very, very happy about that. You call, you get an immediate response in most cases. We do have days like today, though, where I have one trainer in Portland, one trainer in Grants Pass, one trainer in Coos Bay, one of my trainers, technical assistant staff in the office to answer phone calls. He was busy. I fielded about 20 phone calls myself this morning. It's a great service. Unfortunately, we simply can't grab every single phone call that comes in, but I think we do a pretty good job of getting back to folks right away. Again, almost 300 attendees at our annual conference, a lot of posters and handbooks sold, and our customized on-site seminars are a really cost-effective way for employers to train all of their staff at one time at their location that can be customized to their needs. As I mentioned earlier, cities and counties in particular have been calling us lately and just saying, we need to have someone come out and train us on leave laws in Oregon, or our most popular topic is on harassment and discrimination in the workplace. Many employers that have these customized seminars will have us come out and train their entire staff in one fell swoop. California requires annual harassment and discrimination training for all employees. Oregon does not do so. These are the employers that want to ensure they don't have to deal with a complaint after the fact.
Jennifer, back on that. For some reason, I thought in your opening comments you said you had over 17,000 responses.
Okay.
Did I misunderstand that?
Okay. Co-Chair Gomberg and Senator Hansel, we actually respond to around 20,000 phone calls and emails in a year. This number of the 15,000 or almost 16,000 represents the responses that it really was something that Boley Technical Assistance could handle. It was about wage and hour or civil rights or other employment laws that we were able to answer. The other approximately 4,000 phone calls were calls that were referred to other agencies.
Okay, thank you.
A little bit about the staffing. Currently, there are 6 full-time employees in technical assistance. There are 4 trainers. There is 1 administrative person, and there is 1 working manager who also conducts training and answers phone calls. 2 of these positions do receive general funds. That is, those support the administrative function as well as the phone service. And the other positions are other funds and are paid for with fees received from seminars and for handbooks and poster sales. So we are, our other funds is a nice way of saying we have to support ourselves. Pictures of our lovely handbooks, again, the current 8 handbooks that we have. Our most popular handbook is the wage and hour handbook. All Oregon employers need to ensure their employees are paid properly, and that is a very popular handbook. The second one, believe it or not, is the family leave laws. Oregon has the Oregon Family Leave Act. Employers are also subject to the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act. There's also bereavement leave, leave for victims of domestic violence, and a number of other leaves that employers are required to comply with. This handbook, our most recent version, also has information about the Portland Sick Leave Ordinance that Boley Technical Assistance was working with the City of Portland to conduct training and to provide the technical phone and email support for Portland Sick Leave. We're also working with the City of Eugene right now to develop training, to conduct training on Eugene sick leave, as well as answer those questions from those Eugene and Lane County employers around that. And our posters, which hopefully you have seen in other organizations. I was at one business for personal reasons a few days ago and put a little note on their posters that said, Boley was here and you're out of compliance. They were from 2008. This is some information about the statewide trainings we conducted in 2014. Something we hear a lot is that you only do training in Portland, Salem, and Eugene, and 26% of our seminars conducted in 2014 were outside of Portland, Salem, Eugene. We conducted 14 in the coast region, we conducted 16 in eastern and central Oregon, and 15 in southern Oregon. 2 weeks ago, we conducted a series of 6 seminars, 2 in Ontario, 2 in Baker City, 2 in Pendleton, and 2 in LeGrand, and trained approximately 300 employers in that 4-day session. As I mentioned today, I've got a trainer in Coos Bay, I've got a trainer in Grants Pass, he'll be in Roseburg tomorrow. So we really attempt to get all over the state and provide this training. Excellent customer service rating. Again, you know, we do very, very well. Customers are very happy with us. One of our key performance measures was the level of customer satisfaction with technical assistance for employers. Very, very high numbers. And just a quote from the last survey that we conducted, and this is something that goes out in all of our emails, where employers are able to take the Survey Monkey, and we can get information. One of the comments was, more or cheaper events, you shouldn't need to spend a fortune to get good training. But my very favorite was, finally, an agency that, number one, answered the telephone, number two, had great, easily understood info, number three, offered future assistance. Thank you, technical assistance. I brought that one up for a reason. Call response within 2 business days. We've done very, very well with our call response for many, many years. But again, this was... I would actually like to change this to calls responded to when the same business day rather than waiting for 24 hours, and we've done an excellent job with that, and I think we'll continue to do so. Some of our challenges, we are primarily self-supporting. We hear it all the time. Why do you charge for your handbooks? Why do you charge for your seminars? Why don't you do everything online? That would be great. Unfortunately, because we are primarily a self-supporting program, we do have to charge for these services. There is a need to balance the need to generate revenue by conducting those seminars, writing those handbooks, and providing those services that we charge a fee for to support the program, with the need to respond to those employer inquiries immediately. I think we're doing a good job with that. The hope is that as we work to get information out about what technical assistance does to all Oregon employers, by whatever means we're able to do that, that we are going to increase the number of phone calls that we get. We want to be able to continue to respond to those immediately with good, accurate information. Another challenge that we have is new laws at both the state level as well as the federal level increase the number of phone calls we get. I mentioned earlier, we're getting a lot of phone calls about immigration, not something that we can answer, but again, these are phone calls that we have to deal with. I can guarantee after this legislative session, there's probably going to be a couple of new laws that will affect Oregon employers, and employers are going to call technical assistance and want information about that. So there is a constant challenge to keep staff up to date with new developments on both the federal and the state level to be able to take that information, include it in training, add it to handbooks, and to be able to provide that immediate information to the employers who want to know about that. We need to increase our training presence in rural Oregon. I was born and raised in Burns. I worked in John Day. I worked in Baker City. There is a real need to get training to those areas, and we're really working on the best ways to do that. It's really difficult to generate sufficient revenue to travel to those parts of the state. To generate enough revenue to warrant that, especially if you have employers who don't feel they can attend the training, or simply cannot be away from work for a full day to attend a training. There are a lot of questions about why don't you provide this remotely. We are looking we're researching remote training options, doing webinars, and I think that will be good for some things, but I still think employers want to attend training where they can ask questions, get immediate feedback, and get all of those great training materials. Again, I talked about in things that we are doing that are working well, the configuration of the phone system has been phenomenal. Employers are very happy with that. And when you have an employee who is screaming for a final paycheck, or you've had someone come in and tell you I have a disability and you must accommodate me, you've got employers who need immediate assistance. We're looking at the remote training options, hoping to do webinars. We're trying to add some things to our website just to give some additional information to employers. We're partnering with the organizations, the chambers, any business organizations, SCORE, Small Business Development Center, the Secretary of State's Small Business Office, to get information out to employers and to bring the low-cost training to the rural areas. We're really hoping that chambers will be able to work with us on that. Something we started this year was providing half-day sessions versus a full-day sessions in smaller areas to really, it lowers the cost for employers, more information is packed into a half-day, but you don't have to have a staff member gone for a full day, or you as the business owner be gone for a full day. We're also working on an e-commerce project. Currently, we are back in the dark ages, and in order to register for a seminar, employers need to fill out a form, fax it, or mail it. It's time-consuming. Sometimes they forget about that. So we are working currently on an e-commerce project for online registration and for handbook and poster sales, and are continually adding resources available on the website. One other thing I did want to point out, there was a question yesterday about Measure 91 and the impact on Oregon employers. We've worked with the Civil Rights Division. Civil Rights has said it's really not going to change what employers are able to do. It's still going to be lawful to have a drug testing policy. You can still tell employees you can't come to work under the influence. But due to the employer demand that we've had for that, we are currently developing a seminar on the legalization of marijuana, the impacts for employers, since that's going to take about a half hour to do. We're adding other information about being under the influence of alcohol at work, legal testing, prescription drugs, and disability, and layering that all into a 2 to 3 hour seminar.
So it's back. You don't need to back up, but I just wanted to ask registration for your seminars.
Yes.
I understand that you're working on getting that done online, but currently it takes a paper registration to participate.
Yes, representative.
And what kind of time frame do you have there for bringing that to having an online registration form?
Well, for the e-commerce, we are currently working with NIC USA. We actually had a meeting on Friday. I had an email right before I left. We are hoping to have that in place. The timeline says April. I'm hoping for May or early June to have that in place. Mm-hmm. Once we get that in place, we're in the queue to also have an e-commerce platform to sell handbooks and posters, which will mean that people will get their orders faster. It's also going to cut down on the administrative time in my unit in order to allow my administrative person to do some other things to help, maybe answering phone calls would be useful.
And your fulfillment on those handbooks and everything, I say fulfillment, the person who takes the money, writes the address on the envelope, sticks the product in the bag, is that done in-house or do you contract that out?
It is not. My administrative person gets those orders, enters them into a database, and it does go to a shipping and fulfillment service. And we promise 4 weeks, and generally it's about 2 week turnaround to get that. To get that order fulfilled in the hands of the business owner.
Thank you.
One last thing. I'm sorry.
Question for you. How many people do you actually have manning the phones during the work day?
Okay. Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel. There are 5 staff in technical assistance who can answer those phones, including myself as a working manager. 5 of us, but on any given day, at least 2 to 3 staff will be out conducting seminars or working on other projects, the handbooks, updating the website.
So, follow up, if I may. Pretty consistently, at least 2 people manning the phones.
It is always a desire to have at least 2 people manning the phones. Again, like days like today, I've got 1 person. People will call and have to leave a message, but we're generally able to get back with them. If not today, it would be tomorrow morning.
More of a comment. I went back through the presentations and on the inquiry responses too. It just boggles my mind that throughout the department, we're up around 78,000. And if you just do a simple math, divide it by 364, which of course they're not in every day, but that's 200 people responses a day on the average. And I'm trying to get my arms wrapped around how the different departments are able to do that, I guess. I'm not questioning that you are, but that's a lot of inquiries with not a lot of staff to respond. Average is about 2 minutes of response.
I agree.
Other questions?
Okay. So, last thing I want to talk about is we do have a policy option package for technical assistance. We are seeking to establish 2 training development specialist 1 positions. These are lower level positions. These are our positions that would be primarily responsible for the phone services, responding accurately to those phone calls. Again, as I mentioned earlier, it can take up to 2 years to really get someone fully competent with all the wage and hour laws, all the civil rights laws, all of the different other employment laws on both not only Oregon level, but the federal level to respond to. Maintaining the website information, which I think is crucial. Employers like to take a look at the website, see if there are forms they can print off, other information they can find. Assisting with new training materials, which is a constant battle to ensure that we can maintain current on the training. And also assisting with the marketing and the promotion of what technical assistance does. The other position we would seek to establish is a trained development specialist 2, which is the level of the 4 staff that are currently in technical assistance to conduct more of the training, really focus more on the revenue generating activities of the unit, conduct more training in rural Oregon, conduct more training overall, and to continue to keep our employee handbooks up to date, as well as adding new employer resources such as handbooks, online training, and those types of activities.
Questions? All right, well, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Lisper, you've been very patient. You have anything to share with us?
I do, brief. Good afternoon, Chairman Gomberg and committee members. Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office. My presentation will be brief since a lot of the information has already been previously covered. A couple of points I do just want to reiterate on as I mentioned, some of the emerging issues for the agency, and that they're working towards the demand for the skilled labor, which was mentioned previously in the discussion, and the growth needs basically for replacing an aging workforce and the work that they're doing. The other thing that's an emerging issue is the meeting of the middle 40 within the state's 40-40-20 education goals. And to address the needs for adults to earn associate degrees or post-secondary credentials, and the agency is working to contribute to that goal and will need to increase their communication outreach efforts as they bring new occupations into regulated apprenticeship programs and work to develop programs that will meet the instructional objectives for these employers. The other thing to mention about BOLI is where they fit in the 10-year plan for Oregon. And I just want to briefly touch on that, the Oregon supports the diverse, dynamic, and sustainable economy that drives jobs, creations, and prosperity for all. And how they do that is in fostering collaborations with improving government engagement, transparency, and accountability, while utilizing best practices and partnerships. They also do this also by offering and providing technical assistance for employers with education and training. The enforcement efforts that they do to assist disadvantaged workers to strive to break barriers in emerging industry sectors. They bridge income inequality gaps, promoting Oregon middle class growth and promoting minority and women-owned businesses to win a larger portion of state contracts and offer business workforce needs to expand international markets.
Ms. Lister, you touched on the 40-40-20. I just want to make sure I understand clearly. If the apprenticeship program generates a certificate, which would then qualify under the second 40?
That's my understanding in the direction of the goal for the 40-40-20. Bully can correct me if I'm...
And I'm getting a thumbs up from the commissioner. Thank you.
Their expenditure history has already been covered, so I'm not going to go into that. But the investments in the and the governor's budget was presented were in support of the technical assistance for the employers, the positions that they mentioned in their policy option package, and to support services program highway diversity, that position that was a limited duration to the policy option package allows it to become a permanent position rather than a limited duration position. And it is fully funded by DOT. And that's all I have in my presentation, short as it is.
See if anybody questions. Wants to add to it. Is there any questions for Ms. Lisper? I don't see any, so I think we're good.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I was going to call the commissioner back at the end of our hearing, but I have one person signed up, Ms. McGuire. You'd like to come up and introduce yourself. Thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. My name is Peggy McGuire. I'm the Executive Director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. And I just had a couple of things that I feel it's very important for you to know about BOLI's budget. BOLI is fundamental to the enforcement of fair housing in Oregon. My agency is a private nonprofit agency, and we exist to identify victims of illegal discrimination in housing and to work with housing providers to help them understand their obligations so that they don't discriminate. So one way or the other, preventing and eliminating discrimination here in Oregon in housing. For a number of years, I worked closely with BOLI to ensure that all of our statutory requirements in Oregon were substantially equivalent to the federal statutes, so BOLI could contract with HUD to do enforcement locally. Because quite honestly, BOLI does a fabulous job of making sure that the investigations are fair and neutral and thorough and expedient. HUD, not quite so much. We have cases that have languished in HUD for years on end. We had a case that was there for 9 years before HUD made a final determination on the case. Bowley has a quick turnaround on cases, and when they have a substantial evidence determination in a case, when somebody's found to have been discriminating, then what happens is either party, the person who was accused of discriminating or the person who is the victim, the alleged victim of discrimination, can elect to take that case and go outside the Bowley administrative process and actually be heard in state or federal court. Oftentimes, they believe that a judge or jury may find more favorably than an administrative law judge hearings examiner. And in those cases, the way the law reads, Bowley is required to actually represent the victim of discrimination in those cases in the court hearing. Many, 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 by far overwhelmingly, the number of people who are the victims of discrimination are low-income folks who could not otherwise afford an attorney to represent them in a private civil rights action like that. So they're dependent upon Department of Justice to represent Bowley in those cases and represent the victims of discrimination. Bowley has a bill before the Senate, or actually before the legislature this year, and I think that Commissioner Avakian discussed that very briefly yesterday, that will impact their budget one way or the other. If Senate Bill 380 passes, Bowley will have at their discretion the ability to say they're not going to represent these victims in private civil hearings, which means that they will be out of compliance with their contract with HUD, and they will no longer be eligible to receive funding from HUD to investigate the cases. If the bill doesn't pass and we remain in substantial equivalency in Oregon, then there will be a substantial cost to Bowley to continue to represent these cases because the Department of Justice bills are, quite frankly, high. So one way or the other, the budget is impacted, and I just wanted to make sure that you understand how important that piece is to consider, and also how important Bowley's great work is to fair housing enforcement in Oregon.
Well, thank you so much. Where's your council based at?
Our office is in Portland, but we serve the entire state of Oregon.
That's going to be my next question. Yep. Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions for Ms. McGuire? Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else that wanted to testify that's here today? In that case, Commissioner, if you'd like to come in and back clean up, we'd welcome you back to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't know that there's any more swinging left to be done, but I'm happy to wrap up with any questions that you may have after having heard everybody from the agency.
Questions for the Commissioner?
I might just...
yes, Senator.
Thank you. Before you came in, I would just made the comment on the slide presentations of the number of responses and phone calls and stuff. And just a quick thumbnail as I went back through and added them up, your agency and the different divisions that were on the screen, and there are probably a whole lot more that didn't record them. You know, 78,000 for the year, just to me seems like a fairly high number, and I'm just amazed how you're able to respond to them all. It's more of a comment, maybe a question, I'm not sure. But
well, Mr. Chair and Senator, since you teed it up for me so nicely, yes, we do have very committed folks at the Bureau that really perform with superhuman efforts sometimes in order to answer not only the calls that come into the enforcement divisions from folks that just have questions about their rights, but the roughly 20,000 calls a year that go into the technical assistance program. It's very difficult to keep up with all those calls, but you know, it's one of the more necessary things that we do to make sure that people know what their rights are and to make sure that employers have all the tools they need in order to not get into trouble in the first place. So we just do it.
Other questions? I think we're good, sir, but I appreciate you being here with us for round two.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
All right. If there's nothing else on this topic, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on 5517. Ms. Deister, we have tomorrow the Employment Division.
Yes, yes you do, Mr. Chair. The Employment Department will be coming for Wednesday and Thursday hearing. They've got a lot of requests that you will be hearing about, and so the materials are currently posted online, and I'd encourage you to read ahead and take a quick look at those.
I have it on good authority that we're looking at 15 policy option packages.
There were 15 policy option packages in the agency request.
But we'll have a couple of interesting days. Anything else before we adjourn? All right, we are adjourned then. We are adjourned then.